This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Listen to us on KPFK, KPFA, and other Pacifica affiliates, and watch us on Free Speech TV, Monday through Friday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. In the ongoing quest to make sense of Donald Trump's Electoral College win, many have fixated on the prevalence of so-called fake news. These are reports by blogs or dubious websites calling themselves news sites that have sensationalist headlines, often with entirely made-up stories that encourage clicks and shares. There is a serious financial incentive to write such stories. The more they freak people out, the more ad revenues the writers collect. But the consequences can be grave. The Washington Post recently interviewed one such fake news writer who felt it might be partly his fault that Trump was elected. He confessed to making up a story about pro-Clinton protesters being paid $3,500. That story was picked up by Trump's campaign chief and passed around as fact. According to the fake news writer, quote, "My sites were picked up by Trump supporters all the time. His followers don't fact-check anything. They'll post everything, believe anything." Facebook, which is the main platform on which fake news gets shared, has promised to install a process to crack down on it. But is that the right approach? Joining me to help discuss these is Mara Einstein, a professor of media studies at Queens College at the City University of New York. She's an independent marketing consultant and has been working in or writing about media and marketing for more than 25 years. She's been an executive at NBC, MTV Networks, and at major advertising agencies. And recently, she had been on our program to talk about her new book, Black Ops Advertising, Native Ads, Content Marketing, and the Covert World of the Digital Cell. Welcome back to the program, Mara.
Thank you, Sonali. Thanks for having me back. I'm really excited to talk about this.
I know this has been sort of confounding me, angering me, infuriating me for a long time. First, let's talk about what the incentive is for fake news. Is it clear that to you that most of these fake news stories are simply clickbait because of the advertising incentive and the money-making incentive that the internet has now been built on?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. If you read a number of the stories that people who've created this content have said, they're not politically minded one way or another. They're doing specifically in order to generate the ad revenue. And what we know about what creates ad revenue in the online space is the more people that click on your site, the more people that engage with your content, the more advertising you're able to generate. So there's no incentive to create anything that has any kind of substance behind it. There's the whole motivation, the whole incentive is to create content that is going to get people to click on it. You know, what people have talked about in terms of clickbait. And it's no surprise that these fake news outlets are doing this because traditional news outlets have been doing it for years now. They've understood that in order to get people to read the content, whether you're talking about, you know, Washington Post or the New York Times or CNN or any other reputable news organization, they're writing, you know, clickbait or what one journalist called whore bait in order to get people to interact with the content. So it's not surprising that this is then translated into the same sort of thing for people who are just trying to use it in order to make money.
But the overtly fake news websites perhaps go many steps further, right? I mean, the Times and the Post, et cetera, they might exaggerate or sensationalize the content or sometimes write misleading headlines just to get you to read it. But usually the content is fact-based, usually, and they might put their own spin on it. But we have news websites, so-called news websites, where the content is entirely made up. One example is this viral piece of news, quote unquote, that spread before the election that Denzel Washington was throwing his weight behind Donald Trump. So many different versions of this news story got passed around. Poor Denzel had no idea why this was happening.
Right. Well, and please, I'm not saying that the New York Times is not doing good journalism and that the stories behind what may have a clickbait headline is from them not truthful. Let me flat out say that I'm not suggesting that. But the whole, sort of gestalt of the online space has been one in which people see a headline, they may click on the headline, or they may just simply forward the headline. They're not reading the story behind the headlines anymore. And so it just becomes this echo chamber of headlines without any sort of substance behind it. So, you know, whether or not somebody wrote this story about Denzel and Washington, and whether or not people actually read it or not, they may have read the first paragraph of it, right? And that gets them excited enough to move on to the next thing. But, you know, I see this even, you know, this morning I was at the gym and somebody standing next to me just saw something on CNN and there's on television even, right? There's the chyron that appears on the bottom of the screen. And it just said, Trump is not going to prosecute Hillary Clinton. And he screamed, oh, come on, right? And so the person's not looking for context. All they saw was that Trump is not going after Clinton. And what happens then in the online space is, and this even, I saw this morning, is the story that's going on, and this was on Boing Boing and I think Esquire and a number of other sites, was that there was an alt-right person who was on CNN, and it was something about alt-right right person wonders whether or not Jews are actually people. Well, if you actually listen to the story, they were condemning what he said. But what stays on the screen the whole time is alt-right wonders whether or not Jews are actually people. And that's what people see. That's what people engage with. And they're not taking necessarily the extra step or the extra time to actually listen to what the story is.
Right.
And the same thing holds true also for things like NPR. People are trashing NPR and saying they're normalizing a lot of the things that are going on with, and I'm not going to call them alt-right. I'm going to call them neo-Nazis. They're neo-Nazis. That's what they are. And that's what they should be called. That NPR is trying to normalize them. If you actually listen to the radio shows, they sound crazy. They sound, you know, over the top, or at minimally unbalanced. But people aren't spending the time to listen. They're on to the next thing. They want to read the next story. They want to push another story onto to another person.
Mara, sometimes the stories aren't necessarily fabricated wholesale, like the Washington Post interviewee was saying. That particular person said that he literally created a fake ad on Craigslist about, you know, calling for protesters and offering them pay, and then wrote a story around that ad, and then that was picked up by the Trump camp, etc. So he literally made this up, and it got shared so many times. Then there are stories like the one that the New York Times dissected. The New York Times did this case study on how news becomes viral, where there was a person in Austin, Texas, just an ordinary person who saw a bunch of buses near where a bunch of anti-Trump protesters were gathering right after the election to protest the election of Trump. And this person put two and two together. His only research he did was he went on to Google to see if there were any major conferences that could explain the buses. There was, but he didn't find anything. So he tweeted it. And then a bunch of these fake news sites picked up on it and they turned it into news. So it's, you know, are there sort of many different ways in which these news, so-called news-looking stories get built?
Well, I mean, this was supposed to be the whole sort of holy grail of the internet and social media, was that suddenly everyone was going to have a megaphone through which
citizen journalism.
Yes, right? So that's what we're seeing. We're seeing citizen journalism. But the problem is nobody's taking the time to vet what that journalism is. And so once, you know, some of that starts to get picked up by the traditional news media, then it starts to snowball. So that one thing becomes sort of gets the legitimacy of a major news organization. But you know, if we think about this even more broadly, and we think about it more broadly in terms of the work that I've been doing for the last couple of years, I mean, this shouldn't surprise us at all about fake news. Advertising has been fake news for the last 2 or 3 years. So the news organizations opened the door for this to happen in terms of, you know, certainly in terms of advertising. They created advertising that looked like news stories, that wasn't news stories, that was fake news. So this is just a continuation of this. This is another version of fake news.
And Amara, not to be overly partisan, I mean, anybody who listens to my show knows that I'm very strongly progressive and I like to lay my values, for everyone to see, because I don't believe in this idea that all journalism is objective. Everyone's own values do come into it. So we know that outlets like Fox News, Rush Limbaugh, all of these right-wing shock jocks and others have for years been taking things that have a kernel of truth and spinning them to anger their constituencies and whipping up ideology. That whole idea of birtherism that Trump is, jumped on for many years and continues to stay on in various ways, that Obama wasn't really born in the US. All of these are the kinds of things that they know will whip up anger and frenzy within their communities. And this Washington Post interviewee basically said that the Trump camp, Trump supporters, were much more likely to believe the fake news stories he wrote and share them because they got so angry and they didn't fact check anything. Is there a propensity on the right to do less fact checking than progressives?
Well, I don't know that I can say that, but what I can tell you is because I haven't done research on that, if some of the stories pan out, that the argument was that more people without college educations were the ones who voted for Trump as opposed to people who voted for Hillary Clinton. But they're certainly tapping in to what we know about what leads people to share content online. And what we know about what leads people to share is something either that it creates awe or creates anger. Those are the things, or perhaps something, funny that you want to share with a friend.
Or cute, a cat video.
I'm sorry?
Cat animal videos or baby videos,
cute
stuff.
Yeah, right?
Which is harmless, but some of these other things aren't harmless yet.
Right, but it's the things that make us angry. So if you think of something like Kony 2012, which was one of the most successful sort of cause marketing campaigns, that existed. Here was a story and a video that was created in order to go after Kony, and it became a phenomenon in a really short period of time. And it's because people got very angry about it. And I think this is one of the things that the Trump campaign and the fake news stories and the Rush Limbaughs of the world and so on have been successful at doing, is to generate this kind of fear, to generate this anger among a group of people who will then perpetuate it. And it becomes this sort of echo chamber. And what's been really interesting to me is this idea of the filter bubble. People are talking about it now like we didn't know about it. The book The Filter Bubble came out in 2011, I think. So the lack of understanding among people that we're not hearing the kinds of things that other people are, that people outside of our sphere of influence are hearing, it's really, pretty shocking to me that people don't quite grasp that.
Right. The Wall Street Journal did this great red feed, blue feed exercise. Mm-hmm. You can go to their website and you can look at what a conservative person's Facebook feed might look like on versus a liberal person's Facebook feed on several issues such as Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama. And it was a really eye-opening exercise for me. And, I feel like I'm fairly well-informed, but when I actually got to sort of inhabit the space on Facebook that a conservative or a right-winger does, I could see how their views might be shaped pretty strongly in a certain way.
I signed up for a newsletter from the Cato Institute so that I could start to make sure that I don't get so caught in a bubble, so that I do start to see what's going on the other side. Now, goodness knows what kind of emails I'm going to start to get because I became part of their mailing list. But I think it is really important for us to be able to look at this. But the other thing I really want to talk about, too, if you don't mind, Sonali, is the idea of what Facebook was for and why Facebook was created and how we ended up where we are in terms of this news situation. Because if you think about Facebook was supposed to be created as a place where you shared information with your friends. Not news information about what you were doing and what your friends were doing and pictures of your baby or whatever.
The social network, not the political network.
Right. And so So what began to happen is that, you know, it became a space where it moved from not having to make money to a site that had to create money. And while all these Silicon Valley guys think they're also very smart when they created these spaces online, what they didn't come up with is a new revenue model. They recreated the old revenue model that existed offline. Now, some will argue with me, oh, but it's one-on-one advertising, whatever. Maybe, but it's still an advertising model. And so what you're talking about is having to generate more and more and more and more eyeballs. But what I'm seeing, and I'm sure you're seeing, and probably a lot of your viewers are seeing, is that there's a whole lot less stories about what your friends are doing and a whole lot more reclicks of news stories, which is also what ties into this whole fake news issue, because that's what people are sharing.
Right.
That's what people are spending time talking about. And they're not spending the time talking about their personal lives.
So let's talk about what Facebook is offering now, some are saying too late, to do, and whether it's the right thing to do. And Mara, I should say, I'm one of these people who completely stopped posting personal things on Facebook, because as a journalist, it became a really great tool for me to be in a network of my fellow journalists around the country. The difference is that I make it a point that every news site story that I share, I actually read start to finish before I share, and then give my opinion on it in a few sentences, you know, much more than a tweet would handle, before I post it. And I try to, you know, post only sites that I feel like I've vetted. And so, but most people don't do that. So what do you make of Facebook's idea? It's put out a list of options and kind of a list of ways for people to report fake news, third-party verifications, et cetera, as a way to filter out the fake news. Is that going to be enough? And is that even the right thing to do? Because what if Facebook then really did start censoring legitimate news on, you know, based on some ideology, which Facebook then suddenly has this huge gatekeeping power?
Right. Well, you know, Facebook isn't supposed to be in the news business. I mean, that's first
right.
They shouldn't have gotten into the news business to begin with. And they're not the only ones either. I mean, Google is a problem too.
Yeah.
And their ability to be able to get all this information about us and then refeed us information based on who we are, in and of itself, I think is an issue. What they need to do is starve the beast. And what I mean by starving the beast is that making sure that certain sites don't have access to be able to generate money. And I think that that part of this and the way that this was originally supposed to work was that there were only going to be certain news sites that they were going to allow onto the social media platform that they would have relationships with. But, you know, I don't know enough really at this point to be able to say what they can do. But I'm sure somebody out there who knows technology far better than I do can find a way to starve them. Because the issue is they're not doing it because they're trying to create a conversation. They're doing it because they want to make money.
Right.
And if you keep them out of the ad network, which is what they're saying that they're doing, if there's a way for them to keep them out of the ad network so that they can't buy into the space, so that they can't make money in the space, then that's how you're going to start cutting it down. Because they're only doing it for money.
Mara, what about the idea of advertising as a basis, as a revenue model for journalism and news is the old-fashioned idea, as you were saying. But the other, the old-fashioned idea to combat that has been media literacy. And I'm wondering, finally, what you think of this idea that in our internet age, we need more than ever to push for the idea of media literacy. Used to be, people like Noam Chomsky and others would educate many of us on how to read the spin in traditional news institutions like the New York Times or, you know, networks like CNN, watch out for the spin. But it feels like that is what's most important. I mean, and it's fairly straightforward, right? If there's a news site or blog that's, that has an odd name or something you've never heard of, that you should immediately treat it with skepticism. How important is media literacy in our internet age?
It's crucially important. I will take that this question sort of in two parts. One, it's incredibly important. And I actually studied with Neil Postman, who wrote a book called Amusing Ourselves to Death. And he talked about these issues of getting so wrapped up in these things that are not of importance, while letting those things that are really at issue fall away. And that's one of the major concerns about what's going on right now, which is that we will get so caught up in what Donald Trump is tweeting about that we don't pay attention to the real issues, which is what is happening to people of color on the street, what are happening to women's rights issues, and so on. So the biggest thing that we can do is stop listening to what is ridiculous noise, which is every time Donald Trump tweets is noise, and start paying attention to real issues that are happening and have real impact on people's lives. There was an article today in the Wall Street Journal about a new study as it relates to native advertising and middle school children. And it's a study that's coming out of Stanford, which talks about the fact that these sort of middle school children aren't able to tell when something is native advertising and when something is an actual news piece.
And native advertising is?
Native advertising is advertising that is created to be indigenous to the site within which it exists. So it can be something like that looks like an article, but is actually has an advertiser behind it. And it will have some kind of designation saying that it's sponsored content, but it's very obscured and it's really hard to delineate what is an ad from what is a piece of legitimate editorial content.
Like an infomercial.
Right. Right. And this is happening on television, too. This isn't just happening on the digital space. This is happening in multiple media formats. But, you know, when I talked to advertisers, when I was doing the research for my book, they all said, oh, no, everybody gets it. They get it. They understand. They understand that this is advertising content. And when I would show it to people or I would do talks at universities, the gasps would go up in the audience that they didn't know that this was advertising content. And that says to me the importance of media literacy. We need to explain to people, yeah, not just middle school kids, adults as well, how to look for what is legitimate content and what is not legitimate content. What has a sponsor behind it? What is biased content? And you were talking before about Fox News, and people could say Fox News versus MSNBC and so on. And that's true. And people mythologize about some unbiased, you know, newspaper age, journalism age. There wasn't any such thing.
Right.
But what there was an opportunity to read many different points of view so that you would finally take the time to say, okay, this makes sense to me. I can find out more information about this, or I trust this journalist to provide me the information, and I believe what's going on here, and so on. And so you begin to come up with your own ideas. Problem is, we're not taking the time to think on our own. We're just looking at a bunch of different headlines without processing.
Right. So we need to become much smarter consumers of news. We need to educate ourselves. And education is the answer to so many issues. Mara, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and spending this time with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mara Einstein is my guest. She's a professor of media studies at Queens College at the City University of New York. She's been working in or writing about the media and marketing for more than 25 years. And her new book is called Black Ops Advertising, Native Ads, Content Marketing, and the Covert World of the Digital Cell. You can actually watch the interview we did specifically about her book on our website at risingupwithsonali.com. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can also find us on Twitter at twitter.com/RU with Sonali.